Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 179 of the True Crime Couple podcast. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope all is well, and we wanted to start off this episode by saying thank you. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Whether you're listening to us, you've left a review, or you're supporting us on Patreon, or doing all three, we cannot thank you enough. It's a privilege that you've continued to listen to us, and you've given us the platform to do what we're doing. We just felt like we haven't told you how much we love you in a while, so we wanted to take the time to do it today.
So, we love you.
Yeah. And now, let's get into it. John, do you want to hear something crazy?
Of course.
On August 3rd, 2013, 17-year-old Alexis Murphy was only weeks away from starting her senior year at Nelson County High School. The beginning of the school year also meant the starting of the volleyball season. Alexis's senior year was going to be her best yet. She was the school's star player, and she'd been looking forward to practicing and winning games with her teammates, to whom she had grown close with over the years of them playing together. But unfortunately, later that month, there would be an empty desk in each of Alexis's classrooms, and the volleyball team would be forced to practice and play without the glue that held them together so well, because she had vanished without a trace.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
In the past, we've covered cases in small towns, but none yet in a town smaller than that of Lovingston, Virginia, with its population of 520. It has been called, in several of the sources that I found, a more rural version of Mayberry, a friendly and wholesome community where everyone was welcoming and kind. Although some may not like the idea of everyone knowing everyone, in this case, it'll greatly help investigators. The family of Alexis Murphy last saw her around 6 p.m. on August 3, 2013, when she told them that she was leaving to go shopping in Lynchburg. The trip would have brought her 34 miles south, down Route 29. It's also known as the Creeper Highway, I guess they call it. Not in the creeper kind of way, but because it creeps up the mountain.
Okay.
So that's why it's
that's
kind
of eerie, though.
Yes. She got into her 2004 white Nissan Altima and headed to the local gas station. Alexis loved using social media and actually had amassed a large following on Twitter. Well, now X, but when Alexis used it, it was called Twitter, so that's what I'm going to call it. And she was an avid tweeter, and she posted several times on the day of her disappearance. At 6:04, she tweeted Bergbound with a peace sign emoji. At 6:12, she wrote, "How about I pull a U on you?" Next, she wrote, "If you don't like what you see, don't look." At 6:23. And then finally, "I actually look cute right now," at 6:40 p.m. And that would be the last the world would hear from the beautiful teenager. When Alexis did not return home that night, her mother and extended family were very concerned. They said it was not like Alexis to just not return home. They knew that something had to be wrong. They knew that even if she was going to be staying with a friend, she would have sent a text message or called, because she always had her phone on her. Because of their concern, they reported her missing to the Nelson County Sheriff's Department. Now here we are going to go back to the point that this is a small town. And for that matter, a small county. Nelson County at the time had a population of around 14,000, and still does. It is sparsely populated. And because of that, the deputy that responded to the call took a while to fill out the missing persons report with the family, because they'd never filled one out before.
Okay, that's actually pretty insane that they've never done one before. But I guess due to the small, you know, scale of the county, I guess it's not out of the realm of possibility, right?
Right, like 14,000 when compared to the size of the county means it's very sparsely populated. And it wasn't for lack of experience that this officer or deputy had never filled out a missing persons report before. It's just due to lack of disappearances in the area.
Right. It's probably like he had to like go back and look at the handbook. Right. How do we fill out this form? You know, like it's probably something like that, you know?
Oh, definitely. And once the report was properly completed, the investigation began. The case was officially assigned to an investigator named Billy Mays.
Stop it.
But not the ShamWow guy, but same name.
Is it ShamWow or is it OxyClean?
Is it both?
No, ShamWow is somebody else.
Okay.
You know, I only know this because of my, or I think I know this because of all the times I stayed up very late and couldn't go to sleep. And I would see all the horrible infomercials. But yeah, I think Billy Mays was OxyClean.
Okay. I'm sorry. I stand corrected. So, not too surprisingly, kind of like our deputy that first took the case, this was investigator Billy Mays' first missing persons case. However, he was thoughtful in his approach. He first wanted to rule out the thought process that was dreaded by the family of any missing teen, the thought that they had just run away. In the detective's conversations with the family, he determined quite quickly that Alexis had not run away and that there had not been any troubles at home. Alexis's aunt, Trina Murphy, who later will serve as the family's representative to the media, said that Alexis was adored by the family, and she loved them equally in return. She explained that her niece was outgoing and full of energy. She was a gorgeous and complex young woman who was vibrant and funny, but could also be quiet and serious. The 519 also excelled at playing volleyball, softball, and basketball. She was everything you could wish your niece or daughter to be. Thoughtful, funny, smart, social, talented at the sport she enjoyed, and she was always happy and loved to make others laugh. From the way Alexis was described by her aunt, it was apparent that there had been no problem in this home. Rather, it was an environment of love that allowed Alexis to flourish into the beautiful young woman she was becoming. It was a household of love and compassion, and certainly not one that any teen would want to run away from. After that conversation with the family, the detectives determined that they only had two possibilities. Either Alexis had been abducted, or there had been a pull factor present. So what I mean by this was that there was no push factor. In history, we kind of talk about this when it comes to immigration, push and pull factors. But I think it can apply to disappearances too, right? When you deal with a missing teen's case, like a push factor would be a reason why a teen would want to run away.
Okay.
There were no push factors present in Alexis's life. So now they had to determine if there was a pull factor present. And that meaning that that's like someone or something that would cause her to leave the home and maybe put her in a little bit of a precarious situation or a situation that was dangerous to her.
Okay.
And, you know, sometimes teenagers don't understand if they are putting themselves in dangerous situations. So they were thinking either that happened or, you know, someone had abducted her, which is a rare thing.
You know, I think what I'm about to tell you, it sounds like it's stupid, but I think it does apply. You know, when you have kids, when they're very young, you tell them, okay, what do you do? You know, you teach them about stranger danger, right? You teach them, you know, don't go into someone's van or car, even though they want to show you puppies. You know,
don't park next to vans.
Right, don't park next to vans, right? But, like, that is just, the scope is increased as they get older. Okay, like, yeah, they know not to, like, get into a car with a stranger, but they might not be prepared for other things that might happen if someone's following them or, you know, just, I don't know, you throw anything else out there, they might not be prepared for those things because it hasn't been really taught to them to do, like, to think that way. Like, somebody could be lurking somewhere. I shouldn't park over here because it's dark. Like, I don't know, anything you think of.
Right. Well, and sometimes you also deal with the factor that teenagers and younger kids too, they seem to think they're invincible.
Right.
And there's also the social media aspect, because Alexis did have a pretty big following on social media. And there is that added danger that parents now have to deal with of who is my child communicating with online.
Yeah. And this is what, 2014?
13.
13. So I think something that I actually recently watched, and I actually watched it because I was like, you know, this could help me in the podcast in the future. And it's so funny that we're dealing with like a disappearance or some kind of like possible kidnapping. It was a guy on YouTube, and I can't remember his name. I can look it up if you guys actually want to check it out on the next episode or something, or we can put it in the show notes. But this guy on YouTube, he is not any kind of police, nothing. He's not a PI, nothing like that. But what he does is he looks at people's pictures. They send him pictures or Facebook posts or any kind of post and try to figure out where I am.
Okay.
Okay. And this guy is able to pinpoint it like with almost like 99% accuracy just by one photo. And he uses so many different techniques, you know, literally like weather, foliage. Like he goes... He actually breaks it down and shows you how one picture that you post can tell you, I could find exactly where you are and wait for you.
Right. So if someone wants to, they will.
Yeah. Like if someone find had that much time on their hands and maybe put it into practice a few times, they would be able to do that.
And sometimes you really don't know who you're talking to online. And that is true.
Yeah.
And it's scary.
The funniest one was it was a mirror, and the guy was able to like find the person based on the reflection of the mirror.
Wow.
Where they were standing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So as the days went on, panic and desperation began to manifest as Alexis's family realized that something had to be very wrong. With the assistance and support of the Nelson County Sheriff's Department and the FBI, who was called in by Mays the day after the disappearance was first reported, Trina Murphy, Alexis's aunt, spoke for the family at a press conference, where Alexis's family desperately pleaded for the return of Alexis. Trina's words for her niece were, "Just know we're working on bringing you home." Another aunt followed up the message, begging Alexis to just hold on. The desperation and sadness of the family was palpable, and it was difficult to watch that media appearance without getting emotional. But it was good that the family really seemed to be in conjunction with all the law enforcement officers that were working with them.
Yeah. And you could tell that their positivity is extremely high right now because they have to be. You know,
they're
you
hopeful.
Have to. Yeah. Extremely hopeful.
On that day, just a day after the disappearance was reported, so August 4th, it was Trina Murphy who thought to use the Find My iPhone app. The Find My iPhone feature had been available since early 2010, but could only be accessed through a paid subscription at first. It later became free to all iPhone users in late November of 2010, and had been something that the Murphy family used on some occasions in the past. So Trina had put Alexis's phone number into the app, and miraculously, it got a location. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that this is where the phone is located, but it means that this is the last area in which the phone had pinged off of a tower. And that's the way it worked in 2010 versus now, where it could tell you exactly, you know, where a phone last was.
It's pretty accurate, you mm-hmm. know, but even back then, it's still a generalized area. And if anything,
very much so,
between, let's say at this point, her Facebook her posts that she's putting out. And also this creates at least a pretty decent timeline and a way to look at it on a map. So that's good.
Right. Well, the family contacted the detectives and agents working the case right away. Alexis's phone had pinged off of a tower in Oak Ridge, which is only about a 10-minute drive from their home. Now, this was some progress after an exhaustive 24 hours of nothing. But before we get any further into the investigation, we're going to take a break here to talk about our first sponsor of the show.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Okay, so Alexis's phone had last pinged off of a location by Oak Ridge. And Oak Ridge was a sprawling estate located just south of Lovingston. It is off of Route 29, but a considerable distance off of Route 29 South, which would have been the direction that Alexis was headed in if she was indeed headed to Lynchburg. So what made her veer off course like that and go to Oak Ridge? First, let's talk about what Oak Ridge is. It's a neoclassical estate that was built in 1802. It hosts large events and weddings. There's also a large farmland on the property that allows for mountain biking, motocross, and four-wheeling. The property was once owned by the historical Rives family, who worked hard to leave behind its past as a tobacco plantation on which dozens of slaves were forced to work. Now it's a wedding venue. A search party was created by law enforcement and Alexis's family, but they had a large task ahead of them. Oak Ridge consisted of 5,000 acres of property, which included farmland, open fields, woods, multiple historic buildings, and a 1-mile horse track. So that's huge.
That is pretty big.
The property was searched by foot and by vehicle along the roads that existed on the property. They were looking for Alexis herself, of course, but also any signs of her that included her phone or her car. Now, because of a police inquiry, they were able to determine that the location in which her phone had pinged was the area surrounding the Oak Ridge Mansion itself. Because of this, the family was asked if there would be any reason that Alexis would have gone to this location or if she had any connection with it. The family explained that yes, they were connected with someone who worked there. This man was an ex-boyfriend of Alexis's mother, Laura, and Alexis had known him her whole life as the two families had always been really close and grew up together. They explained that he was a sort of father figure to Alexis. The family explained that there had been no bad blood and that they didn't think that he would have done anything to harm Alexis. But because of this coincidence, the detectives asked to speak with this man, but did so in a non-accusatory way. They just wanted to know if maybe she had stopped by his job. It was a Saturday in the summer, so most likely there had been a wedding or an event going on that night. Maybe she had spoken with him about something that had or was happening in her life. The man explained that he had not been working at Oak Ridge the evening of August 3rd, that actually he wasn't even in the area. He also said that he had not had contact with Alexis in quite some time. To confirm everything he was saying, they obtained his cell phone records and confirmed his alibi. According to his manager, he had not been working that night, and his cell phone records confirmed that his phone had been pinging and active at the location in which he said he had been on the day and night of August 3rd.
What about communication?
His communications, it's almost like you know exactly what I'm saying.
It's just the next thing, you know, yeah. You have to just... keep thinking the next thing.
His communications also revealed that he had been telling the truth. He had not spoken to Alexis in quite some time, months, and he had not had contact with her the day of her disappearance.
Okay, but there's still something that we wouldn't know. There's no way to find this out because both parties, you know, one could be lying and then we don't know where she is, but they could have ran into each other and had a verbal interaction. We just don't know.
Well, he was so far away from this area.
I see. I'm just trying to say that would be the only thing is that if they somehow communicated whether with each other, like verbally.
Maybe like the day before or day of.
Correct. And then, we could meet up this time. Or it was something like a third party where someone else said, hey, I spoke to this person. They said, meet them over here. Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just like throwing that out. I mean, that's something we wouldn't be able to figure out.
No, not using communication, using their phones, unless that was done via the phone. But they couldn't find any evidence of that. And it wasn't like they necessarily were like, okay, definitely not this guy. They just wanted to move on. They wanted to speak to whoever they could and then move on. This is also 2013. And even now, the pinging of phones is something that's an imperfect science. So it's not something they didn't want to put all of their eggs into the basket of.
Could I just ask you one more question before we move forward?
Yeah.
Did they look into maybe a possibility that he followed her on social media?
On Facebook, but not Twitter.
Right. So, but wouldn't he be able to see her whereabouts or know where she was going since she posted everything?
Now, I don't know if her Twitter went to her Facebook.
Or that her Twitter was not private.
But he was nowhere near Lynchburg. Or Lovingston at the time, or anywhere in between.
I completely understand. Thought I'd rule that out or burn that up.
Good job.
Okay.
But of course, like those definite records are going to come in like weeks later because they do get a warrant for all of his communications and Alexis's. But I mean, he is not considered a suspect.
Okay.
Even after they talk to him, they're pretty certain that he was not involved. And the family was very adamant that they didn't think it would be him either. It could just be that is the nearest cell phone tower that's close to where she was on Route 29.
Right. I mean, I guess it could just be coincidence that they just knew somebody that would work in that area, that place. But...
And that does make sense because this estate, this establishment employs many people in the area.
I was just going to say that because it's a small town.
So the coincidence, it's just kind of, you're going to know somebody who works there.
I don't always trust coincidences, but I feel like this one, it could be the truth.
Right. Mm-hmm. On Sunday, Oak Ridge was searched, but nothing had been found. By Monday, the cavalry had been called in to broaden the search and get the word out into the community about what had happened. Integral to this was the involvement of Alexis's family. They were very involved with communicating with the media and getting the word out there about Alexis's disappearance. They also moved the awareness effort to social media, which grew considerably in a short time because of Alexis's large following on Twitter and Facebook. While the word was getting out about Alexis, the search was also on. By noon on Monday, August 5th, there were over 80 special agents aiding in the search for Alexis, as were the entire sheriff's department and over 200 special agents from the state police, as well as canine units.
Okay, so they're bringing out everything, and that's good. We want this now. I wish we would have had that like 24 hours earlier, but we all know how that is, you know, no matter where it is.
Well, they have to mobilize everybody and then get everything, the ball rolling.
I'm happy to see it, though.
In addition to resources from law enforcement, there were many volunteers. But no matter how many people joined in on the search or how widespread it was from either the Oak Ridge area or the area of her home, they could find nothing that tied back to Alexis. As the first 48 hours came to a close, Alexis's family grew more and more concerned about how her disappearance would pan out. The statistics were not in their favor. And around them, as they stood transfixed, the world moved on. We talked about this 2 weeks ago with the Jasmine Block case, about how hard it is for families of missing loved ones when there's no movement in the case, and slowly all of those who rush to help have to go back about their lives and their days, and then you're kind of just left there with this hurt, anger, grief, confusion, frustration, and really just truly not knowing what to do or how you can help. And this is about the time it began to happen with Alexis's family.
Yeah, the rest of the world keeps going and you are just frozen in time.
Right. As the school summer vacation was nearing an end, practices for the Nelson County High School's volleyball team began. In an interview with the local news, her coach discussed the impact of Alexis's disappearance and the impact it had on the team and the tight-knit community as a whole, and just how devastating it was. Livingston was shocked. They did not think that something as horrible as this would ever be able to touch their peaceful nook of Central Virginia. But just because it seemed as if the physical searches had stopped, it didn't mean that the investigation had stopped. These law enforcement officers, on every level, local, state, and federal, were working tirelessly to find out what had happened. The next direction in which the investigators went was towards the internet. Alexis had posted a lot to Twitter, and it was where she had amassed a large following of 11,000 people, which is a lot for Twitter in 2013, especially as just a 17-year-old girl before the age of influencers.
And TikTok.
Yeah. Since news had broken about her disappearance, more people had followed her, and more people were leaving comments under the pictures that she had posted or things that she had tweeted in the past, especially the day of her disappearance. This made the detectives and special agents with the FBI want to look through all of the present and past comments. Alexis was a minor, and some of the comments she received had disturbed them, both past and present. So, a team separate from the team that was doing the groundwork made their way through Alexis's social media profiles.
No, I mean, that's like the smartest thing that they could do right off the bat here, because somebody within those comments could potentially be someone who would harm her or take her.
Right. Like someone who maybe was a fan of hers. I don't want to use the word fan, but someone who was obsessed with her.
A sick person. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, this is a minor.
Right.
And a lot of the people that were commenting inappropriate things were people who were not teenagers themselves.
It's sad because, like, when, you know, sometimes you don't realize that when you do those things, you can become a target for very sick individuals.
Yes.
You know?
So in addition to people leaving questionable comments before and after her disappearance, and I think that is the biggest red flag, or the people that are doing it afterwards. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But there were also people leaving comments that made Alexis's family worry even more than they had been. Although these commenters did not probably mean to hurt the family, they definitely scared them while debating what may have happened to Alexis on Facebook pages that were set up to inform the community about her disappearance. And it was one theory in particular that made the community very concerned and terrified Alexis's family. That was the idea that maybe her disappearance was tied to a serial killer.
And what would give these people that idea?
Well, the comments alluded to all of the disappearances that were occurring along Route 29.
Okay.
So a lot of young women went missing around areas that were close to Route 29. Their disappearances were linked to Alexis Murphy because she too was driving on Route 29, Route 29 South, headed to Lynchburg. Now, it's a stretch, some of these cases, to include them and lump them together, but we're going to find out something interesting now and then something interesting later, that in a way, some of these cases are connected. So of the disappearances that Alexis's case was connected to, we've actually covered two of them. The first is the case of Morgan Harrington. We covered that case on Patreon. Morgan went missing on October 17th, 2009, while attending a Metallica concert at the John Paul Jones Arena, which is located right off of Route 29.
Oh my God, yeah. Wow, okay.
Later, her murder will be solved because the person who murdered and raped her had done the same thing to another University of Virginia student, British native Hannah Graham. And that's how, once they had the DNA from the Hannah Graham case, they were able to connect that to Morgan Harrington. So before those two cases were solved, those two girls were associated with basically the missing girls of Route 29.
Okay.
But eerily, the same person committed those crimes.
Those two. Right.
Next was Samantha Clark. 19-year-old Clark was reported missing on September 14th, 2010. Now, this is 3 years before the disappearance of Alexis Murphy. She left her home around 12:30 a.m. while only her and her brother, who was 12, were home at the time while her mother was working the night shift. Her disappearance remained unsolved at the time of Alexis Murphy's disappearance. There are a few others, but I don't find them to be connected. I think they're bits of a stretch, although they're related to areas that are slightly around Route 29. I think the MO and the situation surrounding the disappearances are totally different. I'll include them, but I think it's a stretch to rope them in. More like there's a lot of missing persons cases in Virginia. But there's the case of Laura Winans and her partner Julianne Williams. They were staying at the Shenandoah Skyland Resort, which is a far distance off of Route 29, but their bodies were found in the Shenandoah National Forest while camping. And I think, again, like I said before, their circumstances are far removed from the details and the interconnectedness of the other cases. I think more we could lump their cases in, which, you know, I don't necessarily want to do, because every case is important and should be individualized, but with disappearances in national parks.
Right. I mean, and there's a lot of them.
Well, these two women were murdered, and there's early indicators that maybe they were murdered and it was a hate crime because they were a lesbian couple.
Okay.
So that's what I think is different and unique to that case. Whereas, and it's very similar to the final case, which is linked to Alexis Murphy's, is another case we've covered before, and that's the case of Sage Smith. And we covered that in episode 112.
Yeah.
And that's a transgendered woman who went missing in Charlottesville and is still missing to this day. However, there are many circumstances that surround the case of Sage Smith that may provide possible suspects that we just don't have access to, and many different circumstances that were totally different. I would say, if anything, like the Sage Smith case is very relatable more to that of the Morgan Harrington and Hannah Graham case, because they were both out that night, either going to a bar, going to a concert, and then something happened to them. Versus like this Alexis Murphy case, it's like she left at 6 p.m. and was headed somewhere and just disappeared.
Yeah.
So I would connect those three cases more than I would the others.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes like the online sleuths and even people who do podcasts, we like to throw theories around, but sometimes I feel like there's so many different variables from case to case that it's hard to make those connections. And it's almost like some people like to try to, you know, they try to fit the, you know, the square peg in a round hole kind of thing,
right,
where it's like, yes, there could be similarities, but they're not going to all hit the mark. And then the ones that don't hit the mark, are you trying to force them to? I don't know.
Right. And that does have some dangerous consequences, because if we're roping them all in together and then saying that this might be the work of a serial killer, well, then that can deter investigators from the individualizations of these crimes, and that they may all have unique circumstances within themselves versus lumping stuff in together and making situations or evidence or anything that happened kind of fit together. And then you start to dismiss the things that make a case unique. I also think it's important when talking about these cases and the possibility of them being linked or there being a serial killer, that we have to be careful in which the forums in which they're spoken about, because I think it was hurtful to Alexis Murphy's family that although these people may not have meant to sound as callous in just discussing the possibilities of all of this, it was hurtful for the family to hear it hasn't even been 72 hours since she had been missing.
Right.
And I know that it adds, because people are scared, like, what if there is a serial killer on Route 29? But we also have to look at statistics, and it's a highly traveled road area route that people take. So, and it, a lot of towns surround it. So there are going to be disappearances in the towns off of Route 29.
Yeah, I mean,
it's complicated.
Yeah, it is.
But it's something that I had to speak about because it was something that was highly debated and discussed during the disappearance of Alexis. The internet was definitely ablaze with the rumors that this could be a serial killer. And the investigators did have to dispel some of that and do some investigations into it.
I'm all for out-of-the-box thinking, or sometimes when you get the juices flowing and you start to really think about things, it could be beneficial. But like I said, you can't force things.
Well, especially when I think two of the cases would later become connected. There was some truth in some of the cases being lumped together.
Right.
But not all of them. And it also led to even more fear being spread across the community. And not just the community of Lovingston, but the communities that existed along Route 29. Meanwhile, Alexis's family was taking solace in the support that they felt on the internet in other ways. There, they felt like there were thousands of people looking for Alexis and thousands of people that were rallying around them. And that was something that was helpful to them in their time of need. Now, in addition to that, members of the family, including Alexis's father, Troy Brown, were really hitting the pavement, handing out flyers to people and hanging posters wherever they could. And, you know, it's in seeing those videos of the desperation of the family just doing whatever they can, you see what an impact Alexis made in their lives and how much they were fighting for her. But before we get any further in the investigation, we're going to take a break here to talk about our second sponsor of today's show. Okay, let's get back to the case. On the third day of the investigation, law enforcement got a big break in the case. Alexis's car had been found in Albemarle County, which is just north of Nelson County. It was located in a parking lot off of a Carmike Cinemas movie theater. The fear at first was that they were going to find her inside the vehicle. However, she was not inside the car or in the trunk. In fact, nothing was found in the vehicle. There was no blood or appearance of a disturbance at all. The car would be processed for further evidence, but since this was the first lead in 3 days, they wanted to take as much advantage of it as possible. The canine unit was called in so the dogs could potentially track the direction of whoever had driven the vehicle to the location, whether it had been Alexis or not. Unfortunately, though, that led nowhere. The dog had tracked a person's scent out of the vehicle, but it disappeared at an apartment complex across the street. After everyone in the complex was spoken to and investigated, law enforcement determined that no one there was involved. Now, the question was, why was Alexis's car found in the opposite direction? The vehicle was found in Charlottesville, which is 40 miles north of Lovingston, and even further from Lynchburg, which was the direction in which she was supposed to go. So Lynchburg is 34 miles south of Lovingston. Charlottesville is 40 miles north. Weird. And this is even far away from where the Oak Ridge Mansion was, where her phone pinged, which is south of Lovingston. So the theory that the police were working on, which I think makes the most sense and is unfortunately devastating for the family to have to hear and come to the realization of, is that this is most likely the dumping of the vehicle.
In Charlottesville?
In Charlottesville, after the crime was committed.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I was paying attention, but I just want to make sure I hear this correctly. So
I'm here for you.
Lovingston was south of
Charlottesville.
Charlottesville. And then what's the other location?
Lynchburg is south of Lovingston. So Lovingston is in the middle, basically, of these two locations.
Okay.
Alexis was supposed to be headed south.
Correct.
Everything she did indicated that she was going to be headed in that direction. The tweets that she sent out, the pinging of her cell phone off of the Oak Ridge Tower, but her car was found 40 miles north of where she started her journey.
So it's north of Lovingston.
Correct.
That is a little odd. Okay, all right. I got a better picture now.
You're welcome.
Sorry.
That's what we're here for. If you have the question, like I tell my kids in class, if you're asking the question, someone else has it too.
Thank you.
So I'm glad you asked.
Well, I just wanted to clear that up.
So they were really working on the theory that Alexis's car had been dumped in Charlottesville. And something that made them think that even further when they broke this news to the family confirmed that Alexis would have not driven in that direction. She wouldn't have gone 40 miles north because it was an area that she was unfamiliar with. And because of that, she wouldn't have gone there. Like, she didn't like driving places she didn't know.
Who does?
No.
Who does like that, right? But it's a good indicator. Like, the police said it perfectly. It 100% is a dumping ground for the vehicle, right?
Right.
One has to think now, though, if that's the dumping ground, are we dealing, and then the phone being, let's say, south of Charlottesville.
Well, no, the phone wasn't found. It just pinged off.
Oh, it pinged. That's right.
Right.
Maybe whoever dumped it there doesn't, obviously, maybe they live south of Charlottesville as a way of getting rid of it somewhere where they wouldn't look.
Well, I think that that's what that they have to determine now. Is this someone who lives in Charlottesville that was south in the Lovingston area, or is this someone who just is trying to throw them off of their track? What they need to do is they need to find out more about when this car was dumped, who dumped it. So what law enforcement does is they canvass the area to see if there were any surveillance cameras at local businesses or at residences that would have captured someone dropping off Alexis's car. They were able to find one business whose camera captured the area in which the white Nissan Altima was parked. But the footage was so grainy and so far away that the person, like, all you could see was that the car parked, a person got out. You weren't able to determine anything. The sex of the person, the age of the person. It really just looked like a shadow getting out of a car.
And with that being said, the next time I decide to vote for a senator or a president or anything like that, I would just love for them to just say, you know what? I'm putting a new law into effect. We're gonna sign it now. Every business must have a 1080p or 1440p camera, with the appropriate
working.
Yeah, with the appropriate device setup.
Okay, but who's gonna pay for that if the business can't afford it?
Let the government pay for it. They're gonna wind up paying for everybody to be looking for everyone.
Government's
right?
Got a lot to pay for.
Yeah, well, I'd rather my tax money go to something useful, like into finding people who are missing.
I agree. And if you're not committing the crimes, put the cameras up.
Yeah, just like, I think that should just be across the board. Listen, I'm just saying, across the board, they need to have a 1080p or 1440. Let's have some 4K quality pictures going on.
You want some high resolution.
Absolutely.
You'd vote for high resolution.
Think how many cases we've covered where it's like, oh my God, we have a break in the case, some video. And then we look at it, it's like two stick figures crossing the road.
No,
we can't even see it.
Remember the one case where there was a video, but the person was walking in line with the fence?
Yes.
Oh, that was crazy.
Well, guess what? If you had a 1440 quality resolution camera, you wouldn't be dealing with that.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? It could all be solved.
Why don't you run on that platform?
What? Become what? Senate? President?
Yeah.
Me? Nah, everybody would say insane and crazy too much.
Yeah.
At my speeches.
Okay.
I'm not smart enough for that.
So you could do it.
No, I'll be
your campaign manager.
No. But I appreciate your loyalty.
I would be loyal. Now, they weren't necessarily upset about not being able to see the person on the first camera that they're going to find. What they do know is that somebody, whether Alexis or not, parked the car and then left. So they know that whoever they're looking for drove the vehicle within the area, right? So they decided to do something crazy. They pulled all of the public transportation videos and police dash cam footage from within a 60-mile radius of where the car was found in the hours leading up to when the car was left.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I've never heard them do that before.
Yes. And the car was left in that parking lot just before 10 p.m. on Sunday, August 4th. So she went missing around between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. on the 3rd. A whole 24, 26 hours later, the car was dumped.
Okay.
So now they have an incredible amount of footage to sit through. Luckily, they have the assistance from state and federal law enforcement, so they have the manpower to do this, but it's going to take a massive amount of time. And a white Nissan Altima is a very, like, popular car. Now, while this was happening, remember, there had been a team that was combing through Alexis's social media and flagging any comments or posts that struck them as odd. Well, one user had specifically caught their attention. And after they learned through the communication between the two that Alexis was supposed to meet up with this individual after she'd gone shopping in Lynchburg, which was the day she disappeared.
Okay.
So investigators really want to talk to him. And, you know, they realized that this person was 12 years older than Alexis Murphy. So 29. And as they delve further into Alexis's account, they saw that this man, whose name was Michael, we'll leave it at that, had left a lot of comments on her posts. And the two spoke a lot off Twitter as well. When the investigator spoke with him, he told them that he was concerned about her as well because they never met up on August 3rd. He said Alexis had not shown up. She didn't respond to any of his messages asking her where she was, and he basically thought that she had ghosted him until he heard on the news that she'd disappeared.
Okay, but that's interesting that she did have plans to maybe possibly meet somebody.
Correct. Now, eventually this was corroborated and Michael was cleared as a suspect as well, because when Alexis didn't show up, he went out with friends. There's receipts, there's videos of it. So he was cleared, luckily, because, I mean, this man, I mean, well, what he was doing was wrong. 17-year-old girl. But now you're also putting yourself out there to maybe... He could have taken the heat for this very easily.
Right, because he would have been the last person that had some kind of engagement or plan with
Correct.
This person.
And if he didn't have an alibi, there's nothing he had.
Yeah.
But it seemed like all of the work that Alexis's family had been doing about getting the word out about her disappearance had finally paid off, because investigators were contacted by an employee of the Liberty gas station on the 6th of August. So really just 3 days after her disappearance. And this is when they found out that after she had left her home, she stopped at a gas station right off of Route 29, just south of where she lived. Now, this would have made sense. If she was headed down to Lynchburg, which is a 34-mile trip, and she needed gas, this is the first gas station she would have come across. It would have been on the right side of the road for her to go on to. So she was stopping to get gas. Actually, you know what I'm realizing? It kind of doesn't matter. Like, as a person from New Jersey, I'm like, oh, it's on the right side of the road because there's no jug handles in other states. Like, I think of, oh, I would have had to make a U-turn. And
as you said it.
But everyone else, they just get to make a left.
Yeah, as you said it, I'm just going to let it go. But yes, we're the only ones that do jug handles, and it's very annoying.
John hates the jug handles.
I am not a New Jerseyan, you know.
Well,
I'm a transplant.
You're a transplant.
So for me, I'm in the boat like everybody else in every other normal state. You know, we don't, you know, we just make U-turns and just do what we have to do.
No, you don't make U-turns. You just make it.
Or like, we just make the right or
make
left.
Make the left. Yeah.
Remember that one time I did it by like, was it Newark Airport, right?
When John first moved to New Jersey, he refused to use a jug handle.
Yep.
I told him he's going to get in huge trouble. You have to use the jug handle. And I like a good jug handle.
Not me.
But in the state of Virginia, it doesn't matter what side of the road the gas is on. It's easy to get on and off, not in New Jersey. So I digress. That was just me thinking, you know, that's
gotcha.
Convenient. That's the right side of the road. So I'm getting mad in New Jersey where we live on this highway. They're putting all, I love a good quick check. That's where I met John at a quick check. And they're putting all the quick checks on one side of the road, but that's not the side of the road that I have to take to get to work.
You know, just write a letter.
So I'd have to make two U-turns to get the coffee that I want in the morning. So I can't go there. But why do you need three quick checks on one side of the highway?
It's never enough.
Put one on the other side.
You need to write a strongly...
I'm not the only person who feels this way.
Write a letter.
Yeah. I got to get myself on Route 23 TikTok.
That's
like,
it.
We have to start a movement.
That's it.
Okay. So the information that the employee could give was that Alexis had stopped at the gas station between 6 and 8 p.m. They didn't remember exactly what time. And that kind of is going to correlate to when she was sending these tweets, because we know the last message that she had sent out there or last post she made was at 6:41. So that makes sense, between 6 and 8. So law enforcement requested the footage from the gas station so they could see her activity. Now, this is like a gas station with a mini mart, like definitely a rest stop for people to pull off of, because Route 29 is heavily traveled. And in the video, you could see Alexis wearing exactly what her family said she was wearing, going in and out of the store. The clerk had said in her initial interview with the special agents of the FBI that Alexis had been in good spirits and was smiling. But when her family viewed the footage, they disagreed and said that they believed she looked a bit uncomfortable. Because this was the newest piece of evidence they had about Alexis's whereabouts, the detectives wanted to ensure that they got everything out of it they could. The videotape was watched over and over again, and the investigators wanted to ID and question everyone in the video. But there was one person in the video that they specifically wanted to talk to. There had been an older man that had held the door open for Alexis. And as he did, his eyes lingered on her as she passed through. The small interaction could mean something, as he was the only person on that tape that interacted with Alexis besides the clerk herself. Now, Lovingston is a very small town, but this gas station and store is right off of Route 29. So they do get a lot of passersby as customers. But the law enforcement agents hoped that this man was a local that the employee of the store would recognize. And it wasn't just someone who was passing through, because that would be their worst investigative nightmare. The clerk was questioned again, and she said that actually she had seen Alexis talking to that very man in the parking lot in an area that was not on camera. She said that they were interacting in a way outside of the store that made her think that the two of them knew each other or were at least familiar with each other. She said that she didn't know the name of the man, but she remembered something very distinctive about him. He had a Daffy Duck tattoo on his neck.
See, that's very good eyewitnessing right there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, see, that's a lot different than, I thought I saw somebody about 200 meters away. Like, you know, like, that's different.
Very specific.
Yeah.
Very distinct. So as the video was further analyzed, the agents saw that the vehicle the man had gotten into was a painted camo patterned SUV. And that SUV left right after Alexis's white Nissan did.
Okay, so maybe she was being followed by this person. Mm-hmm. It's a possibility.
So this was good news because of the distinctive tattoo. Because of the interaction, the investigators were feeling very strongly about this man as a suspect, and they wanted to catch him right away. So they did two things. First, the FBI contacted the media and showed them the video, a still picture of the man, and a description of his vehicle and his tattoo. Anyone who knew the man was asked to contact them. Next, they went around to other local businesses with the picture they had of the man and the description of the tattoo and the vehicle, and they asked if anyone knew who he was. It was their second tactic that paid off, because an employee at a porn store called Ultimate Bliss was able to recall that on the day of the disappearance, that past Saturday, a man with a Daffy Duck tattoo had come in the store, and they said that he actually visited the store a lot.
Is it really Ultimate Bliss?
Ultimate Bliss.
I think, if anything, the Ultimate Bliss here is that we might be getting the person responsible for this, and we're all these. That's what's, you know, Ultimate Bliss.
Ultimate Bliss. The investigators asked for the store's surveillance footage, and they gave it to them. It was discovered that 45 minutes before the man arrived at Liberty Gas Station that he had visited ultimate bliss.
Before?
Before.
Okay.
So like that very day he had been in there.
Sounds a little planned.
He rented movies and, well, not really necessarily planned, but maybe, I don't know. I don't want to blame porn for anything. Do you know what I'm saying?
No. I was going more, okay, my brain was going to like a very dark area. I was thinking like if he visited a porn shop other than videos, I was thinking like, did he buy like,
oh, I see what you're saying. You didn't know what he purchased.
Yeah, I didn't know what he purchased. So that's why that's why I was like, could it be planned because this guy's sick and twisted?
I've corrupted you.
You have.
In telling you all these true
You truly
pieces.
Have.
I'm sorry.
I would not have
We know the
that.
Worst of humanity now that we've done this.
But I do now.
Yeah. He rented movies and it could be seen on the video that he paid with a card. They then asked the store for records of the man so they could get a name and an address. And finally, on August 10th, the investigators had a name of a viable suspect, Randy Taylor. Taylor lived in a small camper about a mile away from the Liberty gas station on a street called Canary Loop. The camper in which he resided was run down and in horrific shape. When the investigators got there, they found his SUV outside, and that was how they knew it was his property. They questioned him about Alexis and what conversation he had with her the day she went missing. Taylor was uncooperative. He denied right away that he had seen or spoken with Alexis on the 3rd of August. They knew this was a lie, but it wasn't terrible that he had lied to them. It actually worked in their favor because his lie, coupled with the footage from the gas station that proved he was lying, convinced a judge to sign a search warrant for his property.
Good. We need to see what's going on there.
Right. And now that he knew the police were onto him, they wanted to search his property ASAP. So if there is anything there, he doesn't have time to remove it. That very same day, August 10th, Taylor's property was searched. Throughout the process of the special agent searching his property, Randy Taylor was described as calm and composed. While he stood outside of his filthy camper, inside the investigators found what they had been looking for. Proof that Alexis had been there. Inside, they found one black hair, one fingernail, which was embedded into a dirty old carpet, and a stud earring, which would later be determined to be Alexis's Monroe piercing.
Okay, so she was definitely there. There's no way, other way about it.
No. She was there, and something happened. I mean, it was clear there had been a desperate struggle because a fingernail was left behind, as was her piercing. And for those of you who don't know, a Monroe piercing is supposed to mimic Marilyn Monroe's iconic beauty mark. So it's located on like above your lips to the left or right side, depending on, you know, where, because people can choose to put it on either side. So in order for that stud to have been ripped out, there had to have been a brutal struggle.
Right. I think the
fingernail to be ripped off and embedded into a carpet. So she was grabbing.
On. Yeah. I think another important question is what had to take place for her to wind up there, how did that happen? Because I don't think that would be willing. Like, she wouldn't be going in someone's rundown trailer willingly.
That is a mystery.
Yeah, like that's something
that we have to talk about.
Yeah, because I don't think that she would have done that.
So all of the evidence obtained from the trailer was sent to Quantico for fast testing because the FBI is involved. So that's very helpful. It would still be 48 hours, but it'd be faster than any other lab in the country. Next, they wanted to see if they could find Alexis's cell phone. So the following day, on August 11th, the canine unit from the nearby correctional facility was brought in. These dogs were trained to find cell phones in inmate cells, and they were clearly good at it, because in less than 40 minutes, they were able to find Alexis's cell phone located about 70 feet away from the camper. The white iPhone was shattered, but it was sent in for forensic testing just to ensure that it was Alexis's cell phone. And DNA results came back saying that it was her phone and, you know, the content on it, it was her phone. Then the DNA results came back from Quantico. Both the earring and fingernail belonged to Alexis. They determined that the hair that had been left was part of synthetic hair. Detective Mays and a special agent from the FBI went to the camper with an arrest warrant. However, they didn't want to take him in immediately. They wanted to question Taylor for as long as possible and see what he would admit. Because not having to go through a trial and actually getting answers would make things a lot easier for Alexis's family. They ended up questioning Taylor in his camper for 8 hours. They tried to get him to admit what had happened, but he kept denying it all. It must have been very difficult to be in that tiny camper, knowing that they were questioning the murderer of a 17-year-old girl in the very spot where she fought for her life 8 days before.
That is so creepy. I don't know if I'd be able to do it.
For 8 hours, they were in there. They said the smell was horrific.
Oh, my God.
Finally, Taylor got tired of the questioning and said, if you think I'm lying, arrest me. And they did. Randy Taylor was officially arrested for and charged with one count of abduction by force or intimidation. Now that the man that was responsible for Alexis's brutal and senseless murder was behind bars, the investigators could focus on the next question, the one that they had originally started with. Where was Alexis Murphy? Alexis's family really wanted to know that as well. They were devastated to hear what had happened to Alexis, to know what her last moments on Earth were like. They now wanted to know where Alexis was, and the hope behind the sentiment was different, but the passion behind it was the same. It was hard to understand that the man responsible was caught, but she was still missing. To help them get answers, the family appealed again to the public, asking for anyone who knew anything to please come forward and help with the investigation. The detectives wanted to know that answer as well, and they fought for it. After he was arrested, Randy Taylor was brought in for questioning, but this time in more of a formal setting. In the interrogation, which was filmed, as they mostly are, Detective Mays could be heard telling Taylor that he was going to charge him with murder, and he would not let him go until he told him where Alexis was. The detective's temper and anger at the man in front of him got the best of him, and he called Taylor an animal. And in my opinion, I think that's just a factual statement. But Mays, although inexperienced in missing persons cases, was a good detective, and he moved with a purpose. He had wanted to get the better of Taylor, to make him lose his temper, and he did. After Mays had said that to him, Taylor slammed his hands down on the table, stood up, and got angry. In that moment, Mays saw him snap. He saw the anger that Alexis must have seen in her last moments, and he just walked out of the room because he got what he wanted. Now that was on tape, and the jury would get to see the temper and how quick Taylor was to snap.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I like that kind of tactic, you know, because some people, I guess, do trigger and it becomes very violent. Well, and if you can get just a piece of that, you know, on display.
Yes, because I think very quickly the FBI and Detective Mays, who'd been working on the case since the beginning, saw that this was the tactic that Randy Taylor was going to take. While they were searching his property, he's nice, he's cordial, he's calm. Throughout all the questioning, he's calm, he's denying everything. He seems like a harmless older man who's a little meek. And they're like, no, there's another side of you and I'm going to bring it out. And that's what the detective was able to do.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very helpful during a trial. Okay. But before we get further into the investigation, we're going to take a break here and talk about our final sponsor of this show, Fume. Have you heard that the flavored air category is quickly becoming the leading alternative to vaping and smoking? It's a whole new movement towards better habits, led by the sponsor of today's episode, Fume. This award-winning flavored air device is a guilt-free alternative to an oral fixation that has no vapor, so you can use it anywhere. No nicotine, so it's not addictive. Non-toxic flavors and no batteries, so you'll never need to recharge it. Fume can help fill the void, giving you something to reach for that you will feel great about. Flavored air isn't like vaping. If vapor could be compared to sticky soda, Fume cores are like herbal teas with loads of delicious flavors to choose from, like crisp mint and orange vanilla. Fume is also dedicated to safety. The company continuously invests in third-party studies to ensure the safety of their products, and it's backed by doctors in the U.S. What we love about Fume is the cool design of the product. It calms anxiety with its magnets, snaps, clicks, and spins, but the flavors are what are even better. It's nice to sit out on the deck with the weather getting warmer and enjoy the refreshing flavors of mint or the fun, fruitier flavors. There really is a relaxing effect that we find unique to each flavor. Fume has served over 300,000 customers, and you could be the next success story. For a limited time, use our code TCC to get a free gift with your journey pack. Head to tryfume.com. That's tryfume.com and use code TCC to get a free gift with your order today. Thank you, Fume, for sponsoring this show. Okay, now let's get back to the episode. On August 13th, Randy Taylor was arraigned at the Nelson County Courthouse. As I stated before, he was charged with felony abduction and not the murder of Alexis Murphy, although everyone felt like that had been what happened. The reason why he was not charged with it was because the district attorney knew that at that point they didn't have enough to convict him for murder. And if they jumped the gun too soon, they wouldn't be able to get him for anything he had truly done. Instead, they wanted to hold him on the abduction charge and slowly build a case against him for murder. Randy Taylor's defense team was loud and immediate in regards to what his defense was going to be. They stated that Taylor had not done anything wrong and that Alexis had been in his camper, but had been with another man at the time. Randy Taylor's defense team is actually going to use Alexis's family's words against her in a later trial, where the family is also, as you are and as the investigators are, as to why Alexis went back with Randy Taylor to his camper that day. And the family was kind of thinking, like, she wouldn't have gone back if she didn't know somebody who was there.
I mean, that's a very good point.
So, and what they meant by that was that when, and what I'm assuming, is that when Randy Taylor approached her in that parking lot, he might have known people that she knew. So if he said, oh, are you looking to smoke some pot? Are you looking to have some alcohol? So-and-so is back at my trailer. We're just going to have a few drinks, or we're just going to smoke this, or whatever they were saying that they wanted to do. So maybe he enticed her back with the promise of someone else being there that she knew. And I think that's what the family was saying. But then they in this like court document, like twist the family's words. Like, look, even the family said she wouldn't have been there without someone else. And that's why their defense was that Alexis Murphy came to his camper with another individual and left with that man. So, like, it had not been him.
Well, listen, any defense is always going to try to, like, create doubt among the prosecutor's claims and stuff, right? I think that the family was just genuinely saying, my daughter, you know, is smart enough to know not to do what is being, you know, or, you know, going into someone's trailer, right? So either, you know, that was used to get her to lure her in there, and then that's when she was attacked.
I think that's what it must have been.
It had to be.
Because I can't imagine her going back with that man, just him, because she had plans that day to meet up with somebody else, to go shopping. And my question, and this will later be investigators' question, if what you're saying is true, that she arrived at your house with another man and left with that man, then how did her fingernail and her piercing and her hair and later they'll find her blood get left behind.
Exactly.
That right? doesn't just
It happen. Doesn't happen. And if it did happen that way, then that means that she was, after she was like
brutalized,
then that means that you have an accomplice that you're not telling us who it is, and then they maybe took the body from there.
Right. Well, so, or at the very least, you saw it.
Right. So then it makes no sense.
So he's saying that she came with a man who was named Damon Bradley.
Okay.
That's who he's saying she showed up with. Now, according to the story of Randy Taylor, Alexis came to his camper with Bradley and left with him as well. Now, although this is an attempt to grasp for straws, the prosecution has to see if this can be substantiated, and they have to investigate against it because they know it's the defense that's going to be used. Investigators found out that Damon Bradley was in Alexis's social circle. The two teens had met on Facebook and had seen each other in person a few times after Bradley had gotten a job at the McDonald's in Lovingston. When detectives went to speak with Bradley, they laid everything out that he was being accused of. He was told that Randy Taylor told them that he, Bradley, was selling drugs.
Okay.
That when he ran into Alexis at the gas station, he had mentioned to her that he wanted to buy drugs. So she told him that she knew Bradley would sell him drugs. So that the plan was that Taylor was going to go back to his camper and Alexis would go pick up Bradley at McDonald's. And then she would drive him over to the camper where he would sell him drugs and they would potentially smoke together. Now, Damon Bradley caught on quickly that Taylor was trying to pin this crime on him. So first he responded to the questions about him and Alexis. He said that he thought Alexis was a beautiful girl, but that the two of them had just remained friends. He thought that they had crushes on each other, but things had not had the chance to go anywhere. He showed detectives his correspondences with Alexis, which was later verified as to not having any parts of it deleted. And there had only been a brief contact between the two, but this is days before her disappearance. So if this were the case, there would have been some communication between her and Bradley as to, I'm going to come pick you up from work, or something along those lines, at least in regards to, or even any kind of communication of, you'll bring people to my job so I could sell them drugs. Nothing in their correspondence referred to any of that. And actually no correspondence of Damian Bradley indicated that he was a drug dealer.
Yeah. I mean, that is just wild, honestly.
And when it came to the drug accusation, Damian Bradley told police that he wasn't a drug dealer, but that if he was, he wouldn't have this man go to his house and then have Alexis pick him up, and then he had to leave work
right.
and then go back to work high. Like, that's not what he would have done. He said, if I was going to sell this man drugs, wouldn't he just drive to me?
Right. You don't need an intermediary
right.
to do that.
So weird. The whole story doesn't make sense. And he denied ever meeting or knowing Randy Taylor. So he had no clue where any of this was coming from. Bradley was adamant that it was all untrue. He wasn't a drug dealer. And the investigators not only believed them, but they thought he would be a really credible witness on the stand. He's a very well put together young man. But to physically rule him out, they asked for a sample of his DNA.
Did he do it?
Yes.
Okay.
And when they are going to later forensically analyze the camper of Randy Taylor, no DNA from Damian Bradley was found inside.
Which means he wasn't in there at all.
Or fingerprints, yeah. So I know what you're thinking, because I was thinking the same thing. It doesn't really make sense how Randy Taylor would even know Damian then, if the two were strangers. Like, how would he know that Damian Bradley is friends with Alexis if he never met Damian Bradley, if he didn't come to the camper or sell him drugs? Well, it appears that in some way he knew Alexis. Somehow through someone. Or maybe, as Lovingston is a small town, that one day he saw her with Damian Bradley at McDonald's. Or that someone he knew told him that she and Damian Bradley were connected. And that was the first person he thought of when questioned about what Mail could have been with her that day. And that'll make sense later, because we're going to find out that Randy Taylor hangs with a younger crowd.
Okay.
People in their 20s, late teens. He seems to be a provider of drugs to them.
Okay, which then, hold on. Now that I know that, is it a possibility that he was able to lure her, this poor girl, in there by saying, I got what you need if you come back to my trailer?
That's what I said.
Yeah.
I think that he couldn't have done that just by saying that. I think he had to have said, like, someone else is there. Other people are going to be there. She knew.
That's what I'm trying to say. But
to make her feel more comfortable. But yes, with the allure of drugs or alcohol in some way.
Right, and then also within the same vein there, then that means that Bradley, that would make no sense that he's a drug dealer, because that means that Taylor's a drug dealer.
Well, I don't want to put those words on it. He's not a drug dealer. That was never because I don't want to confirm things that weren't proven.
No, I know. I'm just trying to say based on what they were saying, their own stories don't make sense. You know what I'm saying? To call someone a drug dealer when there's no evidence of it.
Right.
And then most likely he's using that as a way to lure her in there.
Right.
You get what I'm saying? I'm saying the stories don't
make sense. No, I know. I just don't want to accuse him of being a drug dealer to younger people, because that's not what he was.
Okay.
I just think that he ran with younger crowds for a reason. And that's usually when you see an older person being involved with a younger group of people, it's because there are drugs at that person's location or alcohol, or they provide those kids a place to go to use.
Yes.
Drugs or alcohol.
Yep.
You know what I mean? I just don't want to like say something that's not factually proven.
100%. No, I was just trying to make the case.
I'm not standing up for him. I'm just saying.
No, I got you. I was just trying to say with the stories, it doesn't make, you know, it wouldn't make sense.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
As the investigators were continuing to build their case against Randy Taylor, they went back to the presumed crime scene to do a complete forensic analyzation, which Bradley's DNA was compared to, and his DNA was found nowhere in the camper, as I said before. However, something else of interest was found. Beneath the couch, the crime scene techs found a balled-up piece of fabric that, when opened up, revealed itself as a bloodied T-shirt. According to CCTV footage from the porn store, I keep wanting to say star, the porn store, and the gas station, this was the shirt that Taylor had been wearing the day Alexis went missing. It was a Georgetown Miller Lite shirt. Inside the shirt was found Alexis Murphy's hair extension and a false glue-on eyelash that DNA testing would later prove it belonged to her.
But she wasn't in there.
So her blood was left behind, her eyelash was left behind, her hair extensions, her fingernail, her piercing, but she left fine with another guy.
Exactly.
Okay. Makes sense. But charging Randy Taylor would not be so easy. The investigators first wanted to do the right thing and speak with Alexis's family. They knew that the family was praying and holding on to hope that she miraculously would be alive somewhere because her body had not been found. So they explained to them that they wanted to charge Taylor with her death, even without the discovery of her body. But they wouldn't do so unless that was the family's wishes as well. And the family was devastated. But if he had murdered Alexis, they didn't want him to get off on a lesser charge or receive a lighter sentence than he deserved to. So although it was painful, they were on board with the murder charge. On May 8th, 2014, Randy Taylor was found guilty of first-degree murder and abduction with intent to defile. Throughout the trial, and even now, he maintained his innocence. He was sentenced to 2 life sentences. In interviews after the sentencing, Alexis's family stated that they felt like justice had been served. They also said that they hated sharing a room with him and couldn't understand that he denied anything having happened with all the physical evidence that was left in the camper. But the question as to where Alexis was would not remain unanswered forever. 7 years after his murder of Alexis Murphy, Randy Taylor led investigators to where he placed her body.
Unbelievable.
Now, I will say that investigators were very adamant when the Nelson County Sheriff's Department issued the statement that they had found Alexis's body on, and this statement was issued on February 17th, 2021, they said it's important that the people of Virginia know that in no way was a deal made. He received no lesser sentence. He's not getting anything in prison. So we just want to let the people know that we don't negotiate with murderers. So,
I mean, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm just guessing they just kept pressing him until eventually he just kind of, I guess, led them to it.
Yeah. And based on this statement, he revealed to them where the location of the body was on December 3rd, 2020. I'm thinking that he just wanted to get out of his cell. We're talking about COVID and things like that. So I think sometimes after you've kind of been in a cell for so long, your motivation is to get out of it. And he led them physically to where her body was.
Okay.
So this is the statement that was released by the Nelson County Sheriff's Department. On December 3rd, 2020, remains were located on private property near Stagebridge Road along Route 29 in Lovingston. The remains were transported to the Central District Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Richmond for positive identification. Positive identification was received from the medical examiner on February 5th, 2021. With careful consideration for Alexis's family being paramount, notification to the community was delayed to allow them time to grieve and make proper arrangements. With the comprehensive investigation, successful prosecution by the Nelson County Commonwealth Attorney's Office, and the recovery of Alexis, this case is now no longer active. Law enforcement did not work this case alone. We would like to thank Alexis's family, friends, classmates, teammates, and the community for the continued assistance and patience as we work to find Alexis. Alexis's family has asked for privacy and does not wish to speak to the media, but they have provided the following statement. Our family is so grateful for the continuing love, support, and prayers for Alexis and our family over the past 7 years. While we have been grieving the loss of Alexis since 2013, we remained hopeful that she would be found alive and well. Alexis was a fashionista, athlete, and joker of our family. We were blessed to have loved her for 17 years, and her memory will continue to live through us all. Our family would like to extend a heartfelt thanks and sincere gratitude to the citizens of Nelson County, the FBI, the Virginia State Police, the Nelson County Sheriff's Office, and all of the search and rescue teams for your commitment and unwavering support to find Alexis. You all kept the promise made in 2013 to bring Alexis home. During this time, we ask that you continue to lift our family up in prayer, and in the words of Alexis, keep hope alive.
That's really sad, you know, and once again, it's like, I always feel like when it's, I think it's especially harder to listen when it's someone that's, you know, a kid, you know, that's got, you know, so much life to live, and, you know, it's sad. It's like all these dreams and hopes and all these things just kind of die with them. And it's just sad to hear, you know,
it's very sad to hear,
you know, and then this family is never the same again. That always strikes a chord with me.
Right.
You know, it's so hard for families to deal, and also these victims to just not be able to live their lives the way it should be, you know?
Right. I agree. But this case is not over here.
Really?
Despite the fact that Alexis Murphy has finally and lovingly been laid to rest by her family, there's something else. Remember all the young women that lost their lives around Route 29 and how the internet theorized that maybe it was one person?
Yeah.
Well, by the time we get to 2021, we do realize that there are some interconnected details there. That the person who killed Morgan Harrington also killed Hannah Graham. And that person was serving a sentence with Randy Taylor. They were in the same prison, which is interesting. He also shares a prison with the Beltway killer as well. So, like, there's very high-profile people in this facility that he's in. But we think, the internet thinks, and investigators think, that Randy Taylor is responsible for another murder of a missing girl from Route 29.
Okay. Is it like credible?
Very much so. And that would be the case of Samantha Clark. I mentioned it briefly before, but 19-year-old Samantha Clark had last been seen leaving her mother's residence in the early morning hours of September 13th, 2010, 3 years before Alexis's disappearance. She had recently been hanging out with a different group of friends, friends who only days earlier introduced her to Randy Taylor.
Seriously?
Yes. So see, like, he's hanging around younger people.
Yes.
Those people introduced, like, her new group of friends who were kids not going down the right path and seemed to be what was happening to Samantha Clark. They introduced her to Randy.
It's very interesting, though, because it looks like that's kind of how he operates, is he looks for people who are not in the friend group of his own, but on the periphery.
Right. And that's probably how he got Alexis Murphy back to his camper.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Well, remember, this case with Samantha Clark happened 3 years before Alexis. So investigators at the time in 2010 found that Randy Taylor had called Samantha several times that night. When they questioned him, he said that he had called her because he heard a group of girls were going to assault her and he wanted to protect her. And that's why he had called her.
Right.
They did search his vehicle. They found an illegal weapon. They had seized it. He later got it back because it was an unlawful search and seizure. But he was not investigated further as a suspect.
And it would make sense that if somebody was to murder, you know, someone, that it would give them the feeling like they can't get caught and would do it again.
Right, like I didn't get caught last
right,
time.
Right, I'll just let some time pass and let things cool off and then do it again. That sounds like it could be the real deal.
I mean, what are the chances that he was the last person she spoke to and she left the house at midnight and he had called her three times that night?
Yeah.
But at the time, during the investigation of 2010, there was nothing more that could tie him to what had happened to Samantha. And it was really just her disappearance. And her disappearance went unsolved, and it still remains unsolved. However, after Taylor led investigators to Alexis's body, the attorney for the Orange County Commonwealth, which is the county in which Samantha went missing, stated that Samantha's case was being reclassified from a disappearance to an abduction and homicide investigation, and that they had new information and advances in investigative and forensic technology, but that officials would not elaborate on what that was. However, the timing indicated that they believed that Randy Taylor had been responsible for the abduction and murder of Samantha Clark. Now, we will see if that ever comes to fruition, and it's something that we'll obviously talk about if an update ever comes through with Samantha Clark's case. And we hope that Samantha Clark's family will receive the same answers that Alexis Murphy's family did.
I agree. You know, I think that I wouldn't even be surprised if he's using that as like a, I don't want to say trump card, but maybe knowing where her body is, because he, let's just say, for, you know, just for this scenario,
like if
here,
he ever wants something,
if he ever wants something, or he wants to get out again, even if it's just to kind of like, you know, not be in his jail cell, that he would lead them to wherever he also buried her.
Right. Well, he's the only one who knows.
Right. Well, I hope that that does take place, because I'm sure that that family would like to bury their loved one.
Yeah.
So I think that that would be something that, like, you know,
gets done.
Yeah.
It's a crazy case.
This is crazy. Yeah. And a lot of callbacks to a lot of old cases. Like, as I'm sitting here, I'm trying to remember them because, you know, we do so many, it's hard to remember.
I know, because we've done 179 on regular episodes, but we're also at like 117 of our Patreon episodes.
They truly are, at this point, blasts from the past. Like, when you said it to me at first, and then as soon as you said Metallica concert on the one, I was like, oh, yes, I remember that.
I remember her shirt was found.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, before we go, what we want to do is we want to say thank you to our new supporters on Patreon. And we have a lot this month. So I want to say thank you to Daisy Ruiz, Dominique, Rihanna B., Annie Garcia, Laura Mays, Tiffany York, Gloria Custer, Kaylee Ball, Michelle Sims, Haley P., Monica Mancuso, Colleen Harrington Messenholder, Andy, Dana, Alicia Albrecht, Shavante Anderson, Juliana Dunn, Justin Hill, Sonia Ruberg upped her pledge, Kendra Falslev, Kimber Wine, Ruth French, Danica, Beth Smith, Lily Harvey, Aaliyah Cunningham, Sarah Phillips, Griselda Guzman, Maddie B., Kira Knight, Zara Schwani, Sig, Tiffany Howard, Autumn, That One Jamie edited their pledge, Elizabeth Miller, Pamela Murphy, Elise Manor, Tanya Hauer, Emily, and Danny Rodriguez. Thank you guys so much for joining Patreon, and we hope you're enjoying those episodes. If you want two bonus episodes a week and ad-free episodes, you can go to patreon.com/truecrimecouple, or you can download the app and join us that way. Well, until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.